Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, filling in for Randall White. President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden will debate for the final time tonight. They share the stage some 3 weeks after their first debate, a debate headlined by the president's near-constant interrupting of both Biden and the moderator. But tonight, while one candidate talks, the other one's microphone will be muted to avoid interruptions. With less than 2 weeks to go until Election Day, this is the last best chance for President Trump and Biden to build some momentum. Joining us now to talk about it is longtime political journalist and host of the Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Beth. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's the final debate. Simply put, what are you expecting tonight?
Well, part of me is going to be hiding under the couch, fearing a repeat of what we saw back in September with that first debate. But look, and I know I have a lot of friends who said I could not watch this given what happened last time. But given the fact that the rules have changed somewhat, there will be one of the candidates will be muted while the other is talking. This is crucial. I mean, you know, we like to say that these debates matter. In political history, they don't always matter. Maybe when Reagan had a great debate against Carter in 1980, that propelled him to the presidency. But for the most part, nothing changes. The reason why this is so important is given the fact that the polls are very close. I mean, whatever you want to think about Biden's national lead in the key battleground states around the country, the numbers are very, very close. Trump has to make some kind of showing that will change the dynamic. Biden has to worry about some kind of a collapse. I mean, he has run a very disciplined campaign so far. He's always known as the gaffe machine and the crazy uncle, but he's running a very disciplined campaign. If he kind of repeats the performance he had in the first debate, he should do okay.
So, of course, there's some talk that the president may, you know, flout the new debate rules tonight and still try to talk over Biden when the mics are cut, and even possibly attacking NBC's Kristen Welker, the moderator for tonight. So any advice you'd like to offer the candidates regarding the new rules tonight?
Well, I wouldn't dare offer the candidates advice, but I do expect the president not to go quietly. He's already said that having one of the microphones muted, his microphone muted while Biden's talking, is unfair. He's already called Kristen Welker, the NBC moderator from NBC. He's already called her a partisan Democrat. He's already even attacked her parents for some crazy reason as being partisan Democrats. I don't understand the point of that. But the point is that this is vintage Trump. Now, he is under tremendous advice from whatever advisors he listens to say, look, don't go crazy. Make the case for a second term, which he hasn't done, basically, for some inexplicable reason. He's attacked Dr. Fauci in the last couple of days. He's talked about why isn't Attorney General Barr indicting Obama and Biden? I mean, some of that sounds like incoherent rambling or rantings, but his base loves it. His base sticks with it. His numbers really haven't changed. But again, if he is down 2, 3, 4 points in key states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, he's got to change the dynamic somehow.
So you mentioned briefly there about the preparation a little bit, but just stepping back for a moment, who is in the camp? Is Chris Christie back in the saddle in terms of prepping President Trump? And how about over in the Biden camp prep?
Well, the Biden loyalists, you know, from Ron Klain and others like that, they've been with him from the beginning. And the fact is, Joe Biden historically has taken these debates very, very seriously. The president hasn't, but this time maybe there's more on the line given the fact that the election is in 12 days from now. I don't know if the last I heard from Chris Christie, he was apologizing to Americans for not having worn a mask, you know, after he contracted COVID-19. And of course, that probably doesn't sit well with the president because he basically said, I made a mistake in not wearing a mask. And that's not Trump's ideas about how to deal with the crisis. But the fact is, he has, look, Trump listens to nobody more so than himself. He's his own White House press secretary. He's his own Secretary of Defense. He's his own Attorney General. And he has a gut feeling of what works. Now, the difference between this and 2016 is, one, he's the president. This coronavirus took place under him. This collapse of the economy took place under him. For him to just go on the attack and talk about Hunter Biden and crazy things like that, while the American people want to know how he's going to fix the country, fix the economy, and get rid of this virus, I mean, I think there's tremendous amounts of conflicts going on among Trump advisors of how the president is going to deal with this.
Well, former President Obama took President Trump to task over pretty much everything during a speech last night. You have to think that Obama's speech got under his skin. Yes?
Well, I think, yes. First of all, one of the reasons Obama made that speech is that basically Joe Biden is down and preparing for the debate. But what former President Obama said in Philadelphia basically was, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? That's that famous Ronald Reagan line used against Jimmy Carter in the 1980 debate. But he makes a very important case that, are you better off? Like, you know, think of where you were 4 years ago. Think of where you are now. 4 years ago, look, Hillary Clinton was an unpopular candidate who had James Comey and the Russians conspiring against her. I don't know if Joe Biden has that bad luck this time, but the fact is that the kind of things that Obama's saying, look, Joe Biden is not somebody to be afraid of. He is going to make us safer, and he's going to make the country more united. Now, what Joe Biden has to be aware of is that, you know, Donald Trump is going to come after him for his court packing scheme. I don't know why Joe Biden has had such difficulty in trying to explain what he's going to do with the court. But what he did yesterday, he announced a bipartisan commission to basically study the Supreme Court and study the court system in general. And I think that's the only thing he has to say about court packing. He said, I'm going to appoint a commission. But I mean, that seems to be one of his more vulnerable points. And I'm surprised Joe Biden, being as disciplined as he's been, to be so flummoxed over this question. I think he's going to put it behind him tonight.
Switching to COVID-19 right now, Ken, cases are surging in many parts of the country, and many of them are in the swing states. You have to think that the president's going to do everything he can to deflect attention away from the crisis. But can he? And do you think how he handles the questions regarding COVID-19 might have significant implications for his campaign?
Well, look, this, from the beginning, or at least since March or April, this election has been a referendum on Donald Trump and his handling or mishandling of the crisis. And I don't know why that would change tonight. But he, even after he contracted COVID, even after he was contagious right after, or maybe even during the September debate, we don't know for sure. But after he came out, he said, look, I'm completely cured. I'm immune. I'm Superman. And you shouldn't let this destroy your life. You shouldn't let this consume your life. It's really no worse than the flu. Tell that to the 244,000 Americans, or the families of 244,000 Americans who died. If he's still going to minimize the significance and the danger of this virus, then it hurts him. If I can't imagine him changing his tune, but all he has to do is say, look, this is serious, and we are doing everything we can to combat it. You know, that may mean something, but when you're attacking Dr. Fauci, when you're minimizing the virus, I think he's missing a great opportunity to show presidential leadership. But I guess we've been saying that for months now.
So he'd have to change the trajectory of the race, right?
Well, he'd also have to change Donald Trump. And, you know, for all the years we've seen him, that's hard to do. And it's almost impossible to do. And again, with 12 days to go, if the American people don't know what he's all about and what he offers by now, I don't know what a debate could change. The only thing that could possibly happen that could change the trajectory of the race, I think, if just, you know, Joe Biden has a poor performance. Joe Biden is not the greatest debater. For all the rantings of Donald Trump during the first debate, Biden really wasn't so great himself. It's just that all the focus was on Trump. If Biden gets flummoxed, if Biden has a difficulty enunciating what he wants to do, that is Trump's opportunity. But Trump has such a uncanny way of sabotaging his own candidacy. We'll just see what happens.
Well, how about Biden? How do you think he's going to handle the personal attacks? I'm sure that will come up.
Well, look, he was prepared during the first debate, and perhaps what happened with the interrupting and all that thing happened was more than he ever expected. But now, having seen what happened during the September debate, he knows what to expect. He knows exactly what to expect. And he also knows what he did wrong, perhaps by calling, you know, saying, shut up and you're a clown. Maybe Biden feels that was a mistake. If Trump is going to rant and rave and interrupt, I mean, he could do, perhaps Biden does what Kamala Harris did by just smiling and just saying, I'm talking. You know, it worked very well for Kamala Harris. But I think Biden just knows that if he's steady, if he talks about it again, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Here is what I'm going to do in a Biden administration. I think that's the most that Biden could hope to do and expect to do, and leave the president just hanging with the ranting, raving, and interrupting.
The topics tonight, Ken: fighting COVID-19, American families, race in America, climate change, national security, and leadership. What do you make of the topics?
I think those are great topics. I think that's exactly what Americans are talking about. President Trump, when he was addressing reporters, I guess it was today or yesterday, he basically said that that's not fair. Why aren't we talking about foreign policy? But I mean, look, how could you not have those subjects that how could you not have those topics as a subject of the final debate? This is what everybody has been consumed with, from race relations to handling the COVID virus. Kristen Welker, look, she's a great journalist, but so is Susan Page of USA Today. So is Chris Wallace of Fox News. And yet, there's so many interruptions going on by the candidates that, you know, the talents of the moderators get obscured. But Kristen Welker, I think the fact that she's a Black woman, I think she knows exactly what's at stake. I think she knows the issues inside and out. She's proven herself to be a very fair and good reporter. And I think if Trump decides to go after her like he did after Chris Wallace in the first debate, it could very well backfire. But Donald Trump is Donald Trump.
So tonight, when it gets down to the closing arguments, what do you think Biden and Trump should address or will address in their closing remarks, and why?
Well, again, going back to Ronald Reagan in 1980, Joe Biden needs to say, are you better off than you were? Look at his handling. Look at Trump's handling of the virus. Look at Trump's handling of the economy. Look at Trump's handling of race relations. I will do a better job. Whereas Donald Trump will say Joe Biden is a captive of the radical left, that he's going to pack the court, that he's going to, you know, he's afraid or reluctant to attack Antifa and Antifa mobs and left-wing radicals like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will pull Joe Biden so far to the left that you won't even recognize the country. And, you know, he'll perhaps remind voters of his law and order platform. But I think I assume that law and order and race relations are going to come into conflict with this debate. And I think Americans are going to have to decide that whether, you know, the law and order is prevalent, or the fact that there's been systemic racism in this country for so long and that one candidate is addressing it, that could be what voters come away with after tonight.
So for the undecided, what do you think?
Wait. Say that again. I want to hear you say there are people who are undecided, because that cracks me up. Say it again.
Okay, for the undecided.
Yes.
What could happen tonight, Ken? I mean, maybe there are some people that were turned off by President Trump's behavior last time, or maybe there's those people that think that Joe Biden's not up for the task, whatever that is. What could happen tonight that could change their minds?
I honestly don't know. Unless Donald Trump suddenly becomes humble and says, I am doing everything I can to fight this virus. If Joe Biden has falls apart and just, you know, is incapable of articulating what he wants to do, I can't imagine this debate making a difference. You know, we always talk about how debates are so important and how, for example, you know, Kennedy and Nixon, I mean, that was such a great debate, but that race was tied going into the debate. It was tied coming out of the debate. And everybody just thinks, wow, what a, you know, Kennedy was so great. ultimately, in the history of presidential debates, they don't make that much of a difference. And so we'll see, you know, again, if it's a close race, maybe 1 or 2 points could make a big difference. But ultimately, if you're undecided, I think you want to say, who will protect my family and protect my livelihood and protect my economy for the next 4 years? And both candidates will have to make that case.
Well, the debate tonight is being held at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. Why did they choose that location, Ken?
You know something? I honestly don't know. I do know that a lot of previous locations were basically ripped apart. Like, for example, the vice presidential debate was supposed to be one place, and then they moved it somewhere else. It was supposed to be in Ann Arbor, and they moved it to Miami. I know this is, look, this is such an unorthodox campaign. No, you know, the fact that people are not appearing in person, people are not having these rallies, although the president has, Biden is not as much. It's just a topsy-turvy race, and nothing seems to make sense. And I don't think it really matters where the debate is, but I do hope that everybody tunes in, as distasteful as it may be, because after all, this one of these two people is going to be the leader of this country for the next 4 years. And boy, paying attention and voting is so crucial.
And do you know the rules tonight regarding the audience and masks and requirements or not?
I honestly don't, but that's a good question, because the rules have always been that people who show up to the debates must wear masks. But we know that the Trump family in the September 29th debate, you know, Melania and the kids all sat there without a mask.
They refused masks.
And so they made a rule. What? They have face masks, right.
They refused,
and they made
yeah.
a rule for the vice presidential debate that this cannot be repeated. We will eject people from the audience, from the arena, if you don't wear a mask. The same thing happened with the VP debate. The Trump family were not wearing face masks. And of course, nothing happened. But so, you know, there are rules and there are rules. And we'll see if it matters much at all.
Ken Rudin, thank you for joining us on Insight.
Thank you, Beth. I hope everybody's watching tonight.
Appreciate you being here with us.
Or listening.
This morning.
Or listen, especially those undecided voters you talk about.
We'll chat. Okay. Up next, a closer look at the politics of pandemics and what public confidence in government looks like right now amid COVID-19. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, sitting in for Randall White. Our focus today is trust in politics and government during the pandemic. Cap Radio teamed up with Valley Vision to conduct a survey of Sacramento area residents on how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected their lives. The survey found that more people have lost faith in government in terms of their response to the pandemic. Sammy Keola is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter and joins us today to help us understand why public trust in government is waning as the pandemic wears on. Good morning, Sammy.
Hi, good morning, Beth.
Yes.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. What did the survey find on people's views on government during COVID-19?
So we have done two surveys at this point. We did one back in May and one just recently in October. And since the last survey, we saw trust in government go down across the board. And that's whether we were looking at local government, state, or federal government. All three, people trust them less than they trusted them in the spring. But when you look at those three, people generally have more faith in their state and local governments than they do in their federal governments. So 40% of all survey takers felt the federal government was giving a very poor response to the pandemic. and only 20% of respondents felt that way about the state, and only 13% felt that way about the local government. But that said, people weren't exactly praising state and local governments either. Most of the survey takers thought that their state and local governments were doing an adequate job. So better than very poor, which is what they felt of the federal government. But nobody really, well, a very small percentage said that local or state response was good or excellent. So people are pretty lukewarm.
How about how that reflects what's happening nationally?
Yeah, so this is definitely a trend that we're seeing across the United States. I was able to speak with a researcher from Northwestern University. They just put out a poll that asked some similar questions to what we asked. And they saw double-digit declines in this trust factor and this trust in federal government specifically. So what they found was that about 68% of Americans trust their state governments, which is higher than the only 42% that trust Congress and the 46% that trust the White House. So again, a little more trust in state government than federal government, but still a lack of trust across the board and a decline in trust. And the researcher I talked to used a term that I've heard thrown around a lot in the last month called COVID fatigue, basically meaning that we're 7 months into this pandemic. You know, when it started, some people may have thought it was going to be over much more quickly than it was. And here we are, and there's still so much confusion. People are still unclear on what they're supposed to do, what they're allowed to do, when things might go back to quote unquote normal. And people are just really tired. They don't want to try to figure it out anymore. Some people have reduced how much they're finding information or listening to the news. Some people are just going back to normal. And, you know, it's become exhausting for people. And so some of that does have to do with what they're hearing from their local, state, and federal officials.
So, Sammy, what do you make of the findings?
As a healthcare reporter, I think our county health officials and our city leaders have to really, really work hard to get the right information to the people who need it, because, you know, they have to be able to cut through this noise. With the election around the corner, you know, so many health messages are getting muddied by politics. We see scientists' voices being put down or drowned out. And it can be really hard for people, busy people who are working, who have kids that are home from school. It can be really hard for them to figure out what they are supposed to do. And that even varies depending on where you live, especially as California starts to reopen with our county by county, you know, economic reopening system. So, you know, here at CAP Radio, we really try our best to fill people in, but we need local officials to set a really good example. And, you know, something happened over the weekend where some county staff had an indoor meeting where not everybody was wearing a mask, and one of them tested positive for COVID-19. So it's almost a mini case of what we saw happen at the White House. And it's alarming for people. And it does, I think it breaks some of that trust. And I think, you know, both the news and the government have to find a way to rebuild that trust if we're going to keep people safe.
So give us some other key info you think is important to note.
Well, there is just one more thing that the Northwestern University researcher told me, and I should disclose, I'm an alumni of Northwestern University, so, you know, conflict of interest. But she actually mentioned how this trust issue and this fraying of trust could play into vaccinations and who will get a vaccination if a safe and effective vaccine becomes available. And her study found that 59% said they would get a COVID vaccine when it's available. That's a decline from her last poll. So like us, she did two polls, one back in July and one now. So in July, 66% said that they would get a vaccine if it were available, and now 59% are saying that. So not a huge drop, but a small drop. And, you know, it's really going to depend a lot on what elected officials say about vaccines and the kind of messaging that county health departments can get out about the safety of it. Because as we know, there is you know, a large contingent of people in California who are anti-vaccine or vaccine hesitant, and it's going to take some work to get people to adhere to that vaccine, and that'll be key.
Sammy Keola is CAP Radio's healthcare reporter. Thank you, Sammy, for joining us today. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Beth.
Find the full survey results online at capradio.org. Well, in case you missed it, we just discussed how the CAP Radio Valley Vision Survey found that more people have lost faith in government in terms of their response to the pandemic. The survey also found a big difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of how they perceive the threat of COVID-19. Charles Briggs is a professor and medical anthropologist at UC Berkeley and is the president of the board of the Society for Medical Anthropology. He recently wrote about the parallels between the COVID-19 pandemic and a U.S. outbreak of cholera in the 1800s. You can find a link to that and more on all our guests today at capradio.org/insight. Charles Briggs joins us now. Welcome, Charles.
Thanks very much, Beth. Glad to join you on Insights.
In a recent CAP Radio Valley Vision poll, we found a big difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of how they perceive the threat of COVID-19. Around 90% of Democrats said COVID poses a threat to the entire population versus 49% of Republicans who said COVID poses a threat to everyone. So how do you find that, or do you find that partisan divide surprising, I should say?
I don't find that surprising at all. And I'll get to exactly that particular divide between Democrats and Republicans. But, you know, people want to think sometimes that everything started with COVID-19. And frankly, it didn't. The politicization of pandemics didn't start with COVID-19. Rather, it is as inevitable as the emergence of cases and deaths. Also, by virtue of their professional training, one of the key commitments of public health practitioners is to depoliticize pandemics, to try to vaccinate them against conspiracy theories, appropriation for partisan politics, and the public mistrust that ensues when people think that news of a pandemic is just politics. But it turns out to be a lot harder to vaccinate against politicization than even against a mysterious, tricky, and contagious virus like the coronavirus. Pandemics x-ray societies. They expose their rifts, their inequalities that are usually hidden from view, except for the people who feel them most directly. But pandemics always raise those big questions. Is somebody in charge here? Are they looking out for all of us, including me and my family? Does somebody know what to do? Can I believe them? And why are more of my people getting sick than others yet again? So what matters more, in my view, is not whether a pandemic is politicized, but rather how, when, where, and for what reasons. And frankly, the fact that this is taking place on a stage where you have one individual, Donald Trump, representing profoundly and directly the voice of politicization. And on the same stage during those daily coronavirus briefings, Dr. Anthony Fauci, representing the voice of science and depoliticization, and especially when Trump says, Fauci is a Democrat, he's fighting for the Democrats. And then Trump represents depoliticization of the virus as being the way in which his base should respond to it, has really exacerbated this constant tango between politicization and depoliticization.
And you're really saying,
in the end, it's not new. Those numbers are not surprising.
Yeah, it's not new, from cholera to smallpox to other studies that you've looked at.
So it's not new, but politicization and depoliticization takes a different form for each pandemic. So a great example is the 2009 flu, swine flu, or H1N1 epidemic in the United States. So it began in the public view when Richard Besser, interim director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, stood on camera giving a press conference at CDC headquarters. He's not a bureaucrat, but a practicing physician and a very experienced disease detective. And he asked people to change their behavior and politicians to commit large sums on the basis of what scientists said might happen if transmission was widespread and the virus was particularly lethal. What it turned out not to be. When the stage shifted to the White House, President Obama had been trained by scientists to give exactly the same message. And journalists followed in stride, decrying any efforts to politicize what was quickly declared to be a pandemic and generally lauding U.S. official responses. And guess what? Public confidence in health officials was high, and the sort of partisan divide was much lower. So it's not inevitable. It doesn't happen the same way, but always we have that sort of tango between politicization and depoliticization, and always the proliferation of conspiracy theories. A fundamental feature of pandemics was there at the time, but frankly, it makes a lot of difference whether they're echoed by leading politicians or not.
Shifting gears just a little bit, with COVID-19, we're seeing that Black Americans and other disadvantaged groups are dying at higher rates. With previous disease outbreaks, have we seen such racial disparities?
Well, this is doubly visible now. In H1N1, frankly, it wasn't that big. In the 1918, quote, Spanish flu, unquote, didn't actually begin in Spain, they think, but that's what it's called. It turns out that Black mortality from the disease during 1918 was lower than for whites. So it doesn't, you know, I'll tell you, not every virus or bacteria is the same. There are some places where in the cholera epidemic in the 19th century in the United States, and the one that I studied in Venezuela in the 20th century, the racial divides were huge. I studied a small area of a rainforest in Venezuela where approximately 500 people died from an easily preventable and treatable bacterial infection. In the 19th century, in New York City, for example, African-American populations and Irish immigrants were really hit hard by the disease, probably because they couldn't flee the city. They didn't have the resources to get out of the poorest neighborhoods with the least sanitation. Now, when it comes to African-American, Black, to Indigenous, and also to Latinx, cases of COVID-19, serious infections and deaths. Now, this is another time when these broader patterns of health inequality become so tangible. And the Black Lives Matter movement all of a sudden said, oh, wait, maybe this is part of a whole larger pattern where particularly people bear the brunt of inequalities and, frankly, of violence, whether it's through health or whether it's through racialized state violence more than other groups.
So during COVID-19, wearing basic protective equipment such as masks is also a matter of political debate, and wearing a mask is seen as an indicator of one's political persuasion. Are there examples of this in previous pandemics in terms of politicizing actually the wearing of protective gear?
It's fascinating. It was particularly with the some of the early pandemics where the wearing of the mask became really a sign of concern about infections. We saw this with H1N1 in 2009, all of a sudden before, just as 9 cases were reported, as I recall, in the United States, mask wearing was itself epidemic in Mexico. But there was not any sort of partisan concern with this. I don't remember seeing, frankly, I remember when the first article came out in the U.S. press, and I went to a Berkeley pharmacy and tried to find a face mask, and there were none on the shelves. So I don't think that in H1N1, this became a partisan feature of debate. But here, the mask, so this, how you adorn the body, how far away you got, whether you shook hands, became the way in which the politicization of the pandemic really took hold. So now the ingrained association between pandemics and the belief that they're real and the wearing of the face mask was one of the major features now of COVID-19. So these things are shifting, right? The way in which these things register in the news, in how people worry about themselves and their families is deeply important. I'll tell you, I do a lot of work around California, and I can find populations either where people are primarily Democrat or they're primarily Republican, and sometimes it's really hard to find somebody wearing a face mask.
So if you can turn the clock, Jack, if we could, just a little bit, what could the Trump administration have done differently, you know, initially to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 and also have a more bipartisan trust with the community in how he handled the pandemic situation?
Well, in a word, everything. It would be hard to imagine. I mean, look at the United States with its health resources, having the highest number of COVID cases and deaths. I'll tell you, if you look at H1N1, Richard Besser said, look, we don't really know yet what's going to happen, but we're going to take the step right now to make sure that this does not become the big one that it affects, that it causes so many deaths and cases in the United States right from the beginning. And if that had occurred, and if indeed science, right, had been the major way in which people interpreted the virus, if right from the beginning, the science were there from China, there were wonderful sort of procedures that had been placed in practice there. If that had occurred, it has been estimated that over 100,000 fewer deaths would have occurred. But the terrible thing is, all right, so that was the first moment, but there were so many points along the way where things could have changed, including right now.
And right now, what could change things?
Every single one of us to be very diligent in making sure that we observe public health practices. We know that airborne transmission is the most effective route for the disease. So face masks, social distancing, avoiding the sort of situations where you know that you're quite likely to get infected. Thinking about also people like me, I'm 67 years old, who themselves are more susceptible to having a serious case of COVID-19 and to die from it. We need to think as a population, what can I as an individual do to protect the people that I love as well as my community in general? And that's a lot.
Charles Briggs is a professor and medical anthropologist at UC Berkeley and president of the board of the Society for Medical Anthropology. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Beth, thanks so much. Great pleasure.
Find out more about any of the guests you heard from today on Insight at capradio.org/insight. Up next, the evolving confidence and trust in government and public officials. The director of political research for the Pew Research Center joins us to talk about it. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Beth Duncan, sitting in today for Randall White. Our focus today is trust in politics and government during the pandemic. Recent research has shown that many Americans are losing trust in the country amid the pandemic, and specifically their trust in our government and elected officials. Carol Doherty is the director of political research for the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. He joins us now to help us better understand the evolving trust and confidence in government. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about trust in government and our public officials, what exactly do we mean? How do we define trust?
Well, the way it's been defined for many years by polling organizations like ours is to ask people whether they, you know, how often they can trust the federal government in Washington to do the right thing, always or most of the time being the relevant statistic. And you see a long-term decline in the share saying they can trust the government to do the right thing.
Does your level of confidence, do you think, in the government depend on how individually people define trust, what it means to them?
Yeah, no, people have varying degrees of differences over that, for sure. This is a general measure that's sort of used as a gut check measure, asked over many decades. It's one of the longest standing polling questions. And in our most recent research conducted during the pandemic, only 20% said they could trust the government always or most of the time.
So how do you build confidence in the government and our officials?
Well, that's a challenge. Most people say it can be improved. This is a long-standing issue. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, in excess of 70% said they could trust the government. So things have changed, some of that due to events in the 60s and 70s, like the war in Vietnam and Watergate. But it's been persistently low for more than a decade now. We've tried to diagnose this. I mean, part of the issue is the partisanship we see now in American life and American politics, as Professor Briggs described in relation to the pandemic. And so people have differing levels of trust. When they say they don't trust the government, they mean, I don't trust that person who's not a member of my party often in government.
So trust comes then with preconceived notions, perhaps?
Yes, in some ways that's true. And you see that's playing out in the coronavirus, where, from day one, Democrats had low trust in the president. And now what we see increasingly is that Republicans have less trust, declining levels of trust, in members of the CDC and public health officials.
And does this trust levels, do they go down into other aspects of government, like, for instance, the FBI director and people that are in charge of more criminal investigations and everything that's involved in government? And it's not just the president and the Congress, but what about all those people who are responsible for taking care of us?
Right. This is a general measure of trust. I think the public has more confidence in individual areas, individual performance by the government, say, in handling natural disasters. We found a high level of large majority saying that the government does a good job on something like terrorism. There haven't been many terrorist attacks in the United States in recent years, so the public is responsive to that level of performance. But when issues become politicized, like the coronavirus, you see the parties start to split, and that's what's happening in the current moment.
So what does it look like right now? What are you seeing in your studies?
Well, low levels of trust, and low levels of trust in each other, and this spreads to other institutions as well. We've seen declining levels of trust in business and even in churches and religious institutions. We're living through an era where there's not much trust even among citizens themselves. I mean, the public believes, Americans generally believe, that these levels of trust can be improved, but it's going to take a lot of work, and they don't necessarily agree on solutions.
And to follow up, what do we actually know about the pandemic specifically, what kind of impact it has had, not only the way the president has handled it, but just in general, science and everything that's been going on in our country for the last 7 to 9 months?
It really, I think what you're seeing is, there is some encouraging news. I think when you ask about something like mask wearing, you see large majorities members of both parties saying that they do wear masks always or most of the time. So I think in terms of how people are actually approaching it themselves, you see less division. But when you're asking about government performance, performance of the president, performance of scientists, and most importantly, going ahead, would I have trust in a vaccine? You see this declining levels of trust. Our most recent survey showed that only about 50% said they would take a vaccine if it was available, and that's down from 72% in May of this year. So this trust deficit is having an impact on how people are seeing the disease and solutions to it.
How about demographics? How does that play in?
Well, younger people tend to be, and this is not new, younger people tend to be less trusting in institutions generally. This is something that grows as people age, but we're seeing particularly low levels of trust these days. And it's quite a challenge.
And social media is huge in our lives. So what role can you talk about that social media plays in this conversation?
Well, again, you know, the challenges of trust in government particularly predate the rise of social media, but we've seen a fracturing as a result of social media. Most Americans say that social media tends to divide them. And we can see these echo chambers forming now on both the left and right, where people can get news and information more aligned with their own political views than ever before. And of course, that exacerbates the politicization we see.
And how do we decide what's real and what's not when you get into the social media situation?
And most Americans say they can't even, you know, somewhere in our surveys, upwards of 70% of Americans, the one thing Republicans and Democrats can agree on is that they can't agree on what on the basic facts behind the issue. They both say that they share different facts for issues.
And these days, it's kind of hard to separate, I think, especially for younger people. But is there a difference between social media news and then our network news, the news media? What is the news media and how do we determine if we trust them?
Well, most people do trust the sources that they rely on. It's everybody else's sources that are the ones we don't trust. You know, if it's my side, it's okay. But it's a difficult issue for us, because when you say the news media, that's almost a kind of messaging word these days. We try to go beyond that, go at specific sources, whether it be social media or networks or cable or whatever. It's you have to go after the specific sources and the specific sources that people actually use.
So stepping back for a moment, history always helps us. How has public trust in government changed over the years? You know, pre-social media, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what I think we're living in now is just this persistently low levels of trust. We haven't seen these numbers move in more than a decade. I mean, if you go back to the second term of George Bush, you know, the trust was about 20-25%. Today, it's about 20-25%. During most of President Obama's presidency, it was about 20 or 25%. So it hasn't really moved up. We haven't seen trust in excess of, say, 30-35% in more than 15 years. And so this is the new normal. And again, it's very different from the 1950s and 60s. You had a more kind of cohesive society. Most people said they could trust institutions, including the government.
What cases have you found where media, news media, social media actually change people's mind about what they come to the table with?
That's a great question. Usually people go to the sources that tend to reflect their own views, at least highly engaged people do. People still rely on a broad range of sources. Those who are less politically engaged get news from less politicized sources, say local TV, local newspapers, such as they still exist. Where you see these highly engaged individuals, they don't necessarily get their minds changed. They get their positions reinforced by the media that they go to.
So how could we cultivate trust then? How could our government or other officials cultivate trust between the government and the public? What does that look like?
Well, we ask people what they would do, and you get a variety of responses. What do they see as the solutions? As I said, 84% say it's possible to improve this level of trust in government. It's not a hopeless case. But when you ask them, they give you a variety of responses. Democrats basically say, I mean, in the current moment, not surprisingly, they pin a lot of the blame on President Trump, and they say his removal would do a lot to restore trust in the federal government. Republicans see more deep-seated concerns, problems of big government, problems of overweening state, things like that, and government performance in different areas. So there's no consensus on how to do it, but there is a consensus on the importance of actually restoring trust in the government.
And how important is it for our officials who lead us to be really flat-out truthful? I mean, I know in cases people think that perhaps they should protect the public. They don't want to panic the public. They're trying to keep a lid on things, because to do that people could get hurt in a situation, for instance, if there was an actual panic in a, in some kind of crisis. So how do you balance that of being so, you know, transparent versus being responsible?
Well, they're, one of the issues that Americans have with their governments, they don't see elected officials generally, take partisanship out of it, as very credible. More than 60% say they have trouble telling what's true when an elected official speaks. And so they start with this kind of skepticism, and then you get an issue with the president, who's had low credibility ratings throughout his presidency. It's one of the areas where Joe Biden actually does much better. But, you know, I think that's one of the issues is clearly transparency. And the public starts with kind of a suspicious attitude based on, prior experience, perhaps, and that they just are a little suspicious until proven otherwise. And so there's a lot of skepticism out there.
Carol Doherty, Director of Political Research for the Pew Research Center, thank you for joining us on Insight.
Thank you very much.
Find out more about any of the guests you heard from today here on Insight at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan in for Randall White, with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zinter, Megan Minata, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez. And Insight's managing editor is Arm Sarkissian. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.